Okay, so thanks for coming along to this session on mortality modelling. Just the housekeeping, the Institute wants feedback, so fill in the feedback form, don't fold it because it gets scanned by the computer. When we have some discussion, you'll need to speak into the microphone, so we'll take it out and we'll hand it around for you to speak into the microphone. So this session is going to be presented by Carolyn. Carolyn is a PhD student at University of New South Wales. She's in the process now of writing up her PhD. She's been working on longevity risk and mortality modelling, including the application of these models to risk-based capital. But what she's going to be talking about today is some work she's been doing on generalising some of the models and looking at a parameter risk, if you like, in the models. Before she starts, I'll just mention the big word vector order regression. Some of you may have heard of Lee Carter. Lee Carter is a very simple form of vector order regression. So what we're doing is building from what people have been doing before. Carolyn has a BSc honours in actuarial science and a Master of Science in Applied Statistics from Jomo Kenyatta University in Kenya. And I'll hand it over to Carol.
Thanks, Mike. So when we're at yesterday's lunch, we were talking about how going beyond the mandate involved being daring, creative, and innovative as actuaries. So when we're developing this model, that's one of the things that you could say we came up with it, because what we did is we took out from the actuarial aspect some parametric models, and then we took econometric techniques and put them all together to come up with this dynamic model. So this is the outline of how we're going to go through this presentation. First, I'll give a brief introduction. I'll tell you about what's been happening with Australian mortality. Then we'll do a small literature review. Then we'll go into the model itself, look at the results, and then conclude. So Australian mortality. In order to show what's been changing with Australian mortality, we can divide mortality rates into three categories. So if you look here, we have the red are the high mortality rates, the orange are the moderate mortality rates, and the yellow is the low mortality rates. Where you see that we have white, like at the top, that's missing data. So this data is ordered from age 0 to age 110, going upwards. And what we can see is this is from 1921 all the way down to 2007. You have a lot of red towards the left, and as you go to the right, you see that it becomes yellow. So that tells you that mortality has been declining as time has gone by. But you'll see that there are specks of, for example, red in some of the years. Like if we concentrate mainly on the male data, which is what we have on this side, then you can see that even for some of the lower ages, we have some red spots. So there have been times when we've had a bit of high mortality, sometimes we've had some low. So that tells us that there's also some volatility that's going on in those models. And if you look at the very old ages, you see that we have a mishmash of everything put together. You have some reds, some yellows. So as you grow older and older, you find that there's still a lot that's going on. But for the younger ages, generally, mortality has been declining. And the same thing for females. So the aim of the model that we were developing was that we wanted to model the probability of death. So if you think about the principle of parsimony, what it is that if you have a high prior degree of belief in what you're doing, then you're going to need a smaller number of parameters to explain what it is that's going on. So when we look at most of the models that have been developed, you see that most papers actually concentrate mostly on model risk. So they try and find a model that satisfies some criterion. Usually it's the Bayesian information criterion or the AIC. And one common characteristic of most of these models, if you look at them critically, is you'll find that they are over-parameterized. And the other thing that's not really studied much is parameter risk, where you assume that the model that you're working with is correct in the first place. Then you go in and you try and look if you can find a distribution of the parameters that you're going to put into the model, and this is using the past data that you have. So the general conclusion that we've found is that there's not much really that has been done on parameter risk. Yet this risk is very important, especially when you're looking at the tail distribution of the probability of death. And this is very important, like if you need to look at capital requirements and the risk that's involved, or just generally the longevity risk that you have you need to really consider what's happening in the tails of the estimated values that you have. This again is Australian data. So this is the logarithm of the probability of death. So we have the males on the left and the females on the right. And what you can see is that the shape doesn't really change. You have from age 0 going to age 100 that way. You have that age 0, you have a steep decline in mortality. Then it comes up a bit. Then you have like a hump. Then after that, it rises again as people grow older and older. And this is the general thing that happens all through. And that is our motivation for using the Heligman and Pollard model, because it also does a similar thing. It divides mortality into three different sections. So you have childhood mortality. That's the part where you have it coming down. Then you have the hump, which is in the middle term. That's for the middle ages. Then you have the rise, which is in the last term, which is the Compass model. So you put them all together and you have the first law of Heligman, of mortality from Heligman and Pollard. So what we're going to do in this presentation is we're going to represent the parameters that you have in the Heligman and Pollard model by theta. Yes. So by trying to capture how theta changes over time, because essentially what happens with the Heligman and Pollard model is you stand at a specific point in time, you fit it to all the ages from 0 to, say, 85 or 110, then you move to a different point in time, you fit it again, then you move to another point in time. So you have all these different sets of parameters, theta t, that relate to a specific time point t. Now what you needed to do is to put them all together and see how we can be able to capture some relationship on how they change through time, and then come up with a life table based on that. So this is the basis of the table of the mortality model that we have. So there are several advantages to using Heligman and Pollard's first law of mortality. The first one is that each of the parameters has a straightforward interpretation. If I can go back, for example, A is infant mortality. You can explain it very simply. F is the maximum point of the hump. So that's like the peak age at which you're going to have high mortality for the middle ages. And then we have G, it's the base level of old age mortality. So it's a model that you can explain to somebody very simply with good explanations as to what each parameter represents. The model, you can model mortality at a fixed point of time for each of the ages, as I explained before. And you can therefore come up with a time series for each of the parameters and then try and fit it and see what best describes it. And it has been used as a basis for several age period timetables, for example, by Fofara and Smith and McNown and Rogers, and other people have also tried to use it. But we found that in some of the models, it's they've not really captured everything that's going on, so there were a few errors, and that's what we've tried to improve on. So, for example, what McNown and Rogers did in 1989 is they fitted the model to a time series that was comprising up of a set of sequential estimates of the parameters. But what they did is that they assumed that each of the time series was independent of the other ones. But if you look at the parameters of the Heligman-Pollard model, one thing that they have that is usually termed as a disadvantage is that you find that the parameters are all correlated. So when they did this, they failed to capture some of that. And the other thing that they did in assuming that you could fit it directly with a univariate method is they assumed that the time series were stationary, yet they are not. So those two factors worked against them, and they found that the projected estimates that they had were not consistent. So what we did is we looked at the gaps in this work and tried to build up on them, improve on them, and get rid of them. And you'll see how we did that shortly. De La Portes, Smith, and Stavropoulos, they decided that that law was too restrictive. So what they did is they tried to refit at each time point to try and get the best estimate of the parameters. Because sometimes you find that even to fit the Helligman-Pollard at a given point in time, sometimes because you're using numerical methods and you're trying to minimize everything and it's not a linear function, you can have some problems in doing that. So they're trying to improve on that by using Bayesian techniques. So they estimated the parameters and the distributions at a point in time, but they did not go further to try and see how they could project them through time. So that's what... So we tried to now combine what De La Portes did not do and what McNown and Rogers did not do and put them together and find a way of solving that problem. And what we developed was what we're calling the HP-BIVAR method, which is simply the Helligman-Pollard Bayesian vector autoregressive model. So I'll refer to it as the HP-BIVAR model from now on. In some cases, we'll have the HP-VAR. That is the Helligman-Pollard vector autoregressive model. That one does not have a Bayesian component, and we'll see that it'll make some changes. So the basic description of the model that we developed is this. So what we're doing is we're trying to capture the evolution of the Helligman-Pollard parameters through time by use of Bayesian vector autoregressive methods. So it gets the good bits out of like the Helligman-Pollard model, so it's still easy to interpret because we have the same parameters underlying everything. It's multivariate, so it'll capture the correlation between each of the parameters. And it's Bayesian, so it'll keep updating and we'll have more current information going in to tell us more about the distribution. So in order to get to the Bayesian VAR, we need to start off with the unrestricted vector autoregressive model. So a vector autoregressive model is pretty simple. It just tells you that in order to estimate a parameter at a single point in time, it depends on that parameter's own past values as well as the past values of the other parameters in the model. So you have, for example, theta 1 t minus 1 and theta 2 t minus 1. Those are the past values of the variable itself and the other variables in the system as well. And then you're writing them out as a linear combination. So we have the omegas, and each of the omegas and its estimate is now what we're concerned about calculating. So the nice thing about the vector autoregressive model is if you study it further and further, you can actually come up with descriptions or hypotheses about how you think that the variables react together, how a shock to one would change all the rest, and all that put together can actually tell you a lot more about how the whole mortality system is behaving. Then we also have the whole concept of co-integration, because we find that in order to, when we look at these parameters, they're not stationary. You cannot have a constant mean or constant volatility towards them. So the catch with the vector autoregressive model is it assumes that they are stationary, they are zero. But we find that some of the parameters time series are not. So we have to look at if there's a possibility that some of them are co-integrated, whereby co-integrated, we're simply saying that if you take a linear combination of some of these non-stationary time series, you can actually come up with a stationary time series. So the basic concept behind the Bayesian vector autoregressive model is that the vector autoregressive model, it has no theoretical restrictions. So it does not guide how the model is specified. It also assumes that the underlying time series are stationary. And so, so it is when you have, it does not really meet all the requirements that you have because you find that it's assuming that they're stationary, but they might not be. Now, if you try and go further and try and find if there's a co-integration relationship, then that also throws things a bit out of whack. And also another thing about the vector autoregressive model is the omegas that we had that put together the whole linear combination, if you're using the simple vector autoregressive method, they're estimated by use of ordinary least squares. So you find that in some cases, the values become non-zero by chance, which leads to the model of the vector autoregressive process being over-parameterized because you have non-zero values that actually should be zero, so you have unnecessary parameters in the model. So by using the Bayesian vector autoregressive model, we're going to find that we can actually reduce the number of parameters that there are in the model, capture the fact that some of the parameters do not follow stationary time series, and we'll have a more parsimonious system at the end of it all. So the prior that we assume was suggested by Sims and Jha, and what they did is they assumed that the first, that you have a constant equal to zero imposed on the first term of the vector autoregression model. If I take you back here, if you look at the epsilon up there, we have C, a constant. So Sims and Jha assume that that is going to be zero. And then they assume that omega 1 is going to be an identity matrix. And if you have it like at a log of 2, omega 2 is also going to be equal to 0. So if we come here, it's essentially assuming that the system follows a random walk. But this random walk, if you impose some hyperparameters on it, you can actually change some of the parameters that are equal to 0 to be non-zero, if they contain some information that is relevant to the model. So eventually what we will have is we will not have a point estimate for each of the parameters that we've estimated, or the coefficients in this case. What we're going to have is we'll have a distribution of the values that it can take, which is much better. And further, if you look at the normal Weishaupt prior, we'll have a posterior that's also normal Weishaupt, so it'll make computation much simpler. Excuse me. So what we'll have done is the VAR system assumes that everything is completely correlated. The univariate system assumed that everything was not correlated. So the Bayesian VAR will find you somewhere in the middle. So it'll get you a fewer number of parameters, but still capture some of the correlation that we had in the parameters. And we'll end up with a model that has pretty much an optimum number of parameters, and it'll be as accurate as possible. So the other advantage that you have is that it allows you to have both non-stationary and stationary time series in the same place. So the summary of the methodology that we have is, first of all, you need to estimate the Heligman and Pollard parameters. Then you can check them for correlation. Usually you'll find that they're correlated. So I've not really written that down because it's an assumption that they will be correlated. Then you test them for stationarity, which you do using unit root tests. Then you determine the optimal log for the vector autoregressive model. Then you check if there are any co-integration relationships. The co-integration part comes in that when you're forming the Bayesian VAR, you need to have a set of hyperparameters that will put in the prior. I really haven't gone into that, but it's in the paper. It's a bit technical and it might get a bit messy, so we've left that part out for today. Now once you've fitted the Bayesian VAR model, you use it to calculate the posterior density of the thetas, which were the parameters of the Heligman-Pollard model, and then you can estimate your QXT again, the probability of death. So that's a condensed form of how we're going to do to implement that model. So next we're going to go into the results to see how it performed for Australian mortality. So first of all, we estimated the parameters. So you have A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and H, which are the parameters that we had. The solid line represents the parameters for the males, and the dotted line represents the parameters for the females. Then what we have there is we have the correlation of the parameters and how significant the correlation is. So in the upper part of the triangle, that's the correlation. The lower part is the significance. If you have less than 0.001, it means that the correlation is actually significant. And you find that for most of the parameters, you have some significant correlation between some of them. Like if I concentrate on the upper table, which is for males, if you look at the bottom line, H and A have significant correlation. A is infant mortality, and H is the changes in base mortality for the old folks. So it tells you that there's something that goes on. When infant mortality changes, something also changes in old age mortality. This may be, for example, because like if you assume you had a very hot summer, then there might be more deaths in the old ages, and also children might be affected. So something like that. There's something that goes on. So you're looking at the entire lifespan, and you can see that there's some correlation that happens when mortality, say, in children and in old ages changes. So you can see that that's the same. H also has some relationship with middle ages. And when you look at all this together, it tells you that if you are to use a univariate case, then you might actually have some errors coming in because you'll be assuming that they're independent, yet they're not. The other thing that we did is we tested for stationarity, and we found that all of them are not stationary except for the B parameter for females. So it means that we would not have been able to easily simply just use a vector autoregressive model because it would have assumed that the time series that you're putting in are all stationary, which is wrong from what you've seen. So after checking what the optimal lag length would be for the vector autoregressive model, because it still forms the basis of what we have, we found that the optimal lag length was equal to 2, and this is based on the Bayesian information criterion. And we also tested to see if there's any co-integration, because we found that, yes, they're all non-stationary except for that one. And we find that for both males and for females, at 95% confidence, there is at least one co-integration relationship. So it means that when we're trying to use the Bayesian vector autoregressive model, we need to consider that we have non-stationary time series that we're putting in, and also that in those non-stationary time series, there is the possibility that they might be co-integrated. So we fitted a Bayesian VAR2 with the allowance for unit roots and co-integration. So in order to see how well the model performed, the results we're going to present are based on using 50 years worth of data from 1946 to 1995, and then fitting them and projecting them for 12 years from 1996 to 2007, because that's the data set that we have available. And we'll try to see if using those 50 years is going to give us good projections for the next 12 years, and that will be a measure that we can use to gauge our model against. So because we're usually interested in longevity risk at the moment, because we're trying to develop some products that can be used by the old people, we're going to be looking mostly at parameters G and H. And in the results that I'm going to present, we're going to look at old age mortality rather than across the whole lifespan. So G is the best level of mortality. We're going to talk about it a lot. So for example, if we fitted G using the vector autoregressive model, this is what actually happened. This is the data that we have. And what we have, the blue line, is what happens when you fit it using a vector autoregressive model. So the first thing that you notice is that you have a very narrow confidence interval. That is your 99.5% confidence interval that we have there. And it's pretty narrow. Initially, it increases. Then it's like the model assumes a steady state and it stops getting wider and wider. And also another thing is that the vector autoregressive model, because of the way it imposes quite some structure on the system, it will maintain what had been happening. So you see that the G parameter that you have is quite steep in this case. Yet, if you look at what actually happened, at some point it started to decline. And this is consistent with what we've been saying, is that mortality has been improving following a diminishing law of returns. So it's decreasing at a decreasing rate. But in that case, the vector autoregressive model is assuming that it's still decreasing at the same rate. So it's not really updating to catch up with what's going on. This is now using the Bayesian vector autoregressive model, and you can see that this one captures that at some point it needs to decrease at a decreasing rate, and also it captures the fact that there is increasing uncertainty as time goes by, so the confidence interval is getting wider and wider, and that is desirable, especially if you want to look at the tail risk in estimating the probability of death. So this is going to carry on into the estimates of QX that you're going to have because you put this into the model. So the confidence intervals as well will, if they're wider, then your probability of death that you're going to estimate is also going to be wider. So these are some selected years. So we have G for 1997 and H for 1997. That's what we have in this first column. So we have the red line is what was actually observed. The black line is the Bayesian VAR estimate. And the blue line is the vector autoregressive, the VAR estimate. So it's desirable to try and get a model such that the red line is as close as possible to your estimated value, so either the blue line or the black line. And in all cases, you see that the black line is much closer to the red line, which is what was actually observed. Now, this is in the projected years, than the blue line. And this is something that was consistent throughout all the data. You find that the Bayesian VAR model actually gives you a much better, much more accurate estimate of what the parameter G or H is going to be in the future. In some cases, you find that the vector autoregressive model actually goes so far out that it's beyond the 99.5% confidence interval. That's how wrong it gets. And if you look at the width of the confidence intervals for each of those models, the model with the parameter risk, which is the Bayesian VAR, because it looks at the distribution of the coefficients, has a much wider confidence interval. At the first step of the projection, it's 1.5 times as wide as the VAR confidence interval. And as time goes by the 12th projection, which is now for 2007, it becomes about it's between 4 and 4.5 times as wide. These are for the 99 and the 90% confidence intervals. So this is a significant improvement, and it's a good thing when you're actually trying to consider the longevity risk that's within, rather than just trying to get a good estimate of what future mortality might be. So now these are the 99% confidence intervals of old age for the predicted values. So here we have 1997. That's 2 years after we started projecting and 12 years after we started projecting. So the dark blue line represents the vector autoregressive model, and the black line again is our good model, the HPBVAR, using the HPBVAR model. So and the other thing that we have there is we have the small circles. That is what was actually experienced. So we're looking to see if there's which model it is that is closest to the dots. So for 2007, not really much has happened. They're still pretty good. The thick blue line and the thick black line, they're pretty close to the small circles that we have, so they're okay. But as time goes by, in 2007, this is now 12 years after we stopped, 12 years into our projection, you see that the black line is much closer to the blue line, where the black line is based on the HPBVAR model, and the blue line is based on the HPBVAR model. So in this case, the model that does not consider parameter risk actually ends up underestimating mortality risk. Then the other thing is the confidence intervals. If you look at the 1997 graph, you see that the confidence intervals are narrow for the VAR. But if you look in the 2007, they're a bit wider. But if you compare how much wider the intervals for the HPBVAR model are, then you'd see that that actually captures more of the uncertainty that may be going on in future mortality rates. So this model is actually pretty good for trying to calculate longevity risk and trying to get the uncertainty that may happen. So the other thing that we looked at was the root mean squared error. So we took the estimates of the probability of death and subtracted them from what actually happened and got the average of the square of these errors and tried to see, okay, so which one has the smallest root mean squared error? So you can see that the vector autoregressive model, which is again in the blue, had a higher root mean squared error than the vector than the HPBVAR model, which is shown in the black. And we haven't shown this here, but we also tried this to compare what the QX projected for the Lee-Carter model would be, and it's comparable to what we have in the HPBVAR model. It's just that they're two different types of models, so we really cannot put them all together and say we're comparing them directly, but it's just an interesting thing that you could note that it performs pretty well, even compared to the Licata model. So because we know that parameter risk is very significant, especially when you're looking at longevity risk in the terms of uncertainty, because you want to know what's the uncertainty that's going to be in future mortality rates, then it's important to consider this when you're developing a model. You need to capture this so that you can have a model that gives as much information as possible. And the Bayesian vector autoregressive model, it gave more accurate forecasts because of the way that we formulated it with the uncertainty about the parameters being considered. And also, it also gives you wider confidence intervals, so it gives you more information about future uncertainty about mortality rates. And further, it is much better than the HPVAR model, which is what people have really been talking about. We've seen several studies that suggest that you needed to simply use an econometric model, something like the vector autoregressive model, but they do not capture everything that's going on. So this model, the HPVAR, it ends up outperforming the HPVAR model. And eventually, we end up having much more information about the uncertainty in mortality rates, which is always desirable when you're looking at longevity risk. So in conclusion, what we've done in this model is we've modeled the parameters of the Heligman-Pollard model, and we've considered their correlation, and we've done this by using econometric techniques. And the model that we have that uses the Bayesian techniques, as well as combining all this, the structure in the vector autoregressive model, gives us more accurate predictions. We have also wider confidence intervals because we've captured not just the uncertainty in the models, but we've also looked at the uncertainty that's brought in by the parameters. And by using the Bayesian model, we've been able to get rid of non-zero parameters that just happened to be zero by chance. And we've gotten rid of parameters that should be zero but were non-zero by chance, and therefore reduced the number of parameters, therefore ending up with a more parsimonious model. And we've got a much, much better model. But there's one shortcoming that we have of this model. Because it's based on the Heligman-Pollard model, which is not very good for females, this model at the moment mostly works for males. But still, it's been a significant improvement because we found it's more parsimonious, it has wider confidence intervals, it's all desirable. So now, with the exception of the fact that it has poor performance for females, so far it's been quite adequate for our requirements. To look at modeling it for females, what you're thinking is perhaps other models that are parametric, like the Kolenkiska model, may be suitable. Then, once you have those parameters, once you have a way of fitting the time series of those parameters through time, then it all becomes much easier. And the Bayesian vector autoregressive model has shown that it has the capability to put all these things together and make that a much more manageable task. So that's the presentation. Thank you.
Microphone.
I saw the thank you for a very interesting presentation. I saw the work that you did there in relation to the 50 years, where you then project the subsequent 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, thanks for going for the slide. That one, yeah, exactly that one. I wondered if you'd done that same test of cutting the data off, say, at 40 years,
mm-hmm.
and doing the same projection there. Because it seems to me that's a sample of one of how well it performed at that particular point in time, and I just wondered how variable it is according to where you cut the data off.
Yeah. I've tried that because I started off using 20 years, then projecting it on and so forth. When you have a smaller data set, you find that the first set of fitted values, like even here, initially it's not very accurate. You have it takes some while for it to train and get enough information for the values to become accurate. So you need a pretty big sample size to start off with. But if you have about 50 years is good, 40 years is also okay. I've also used larger data sizes, and I found that the Bayesian VAR still outperforms. Like, there's going to be the pension symposium in July at UNSW. We'll present now a different set of time periods where we still find that the Bayesian VAR is still accurate. And what we've done is we've used a different time period, and it still works. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that question would be, if you'd done it 10 years earlier, would it have been forecasting a...
Downwards,
yeah.
I believe so.
Yeah.
Because it trains on... It gives more weight to the closer observations. Yeah.
I was always... If I can just follow up quickly, I was always taught to ask really stupid questions, but one of them is that the advantages that you claimed at the end were mm-hmm. that you had wider confidence intervals.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure whether that's an advantage or a disadvantage. If you're simply saying that that's the truth, mm-hmm. and therefore it reflects reality, then I understand. So thank you. Yeah. No, that's fine.
I was just interested in. You talked about the correlations between the early ages and the old ages.
Mm-hmm.
From an insurance sort of company-wide point of view, I'm interested in the mid-ages versus the old ages because you've got the annuity portfolio and the insured lives. I just wanted to know if you had any comments on the correlations between those.
Between the middle ages and the old ages?
Yes.
Okay. What I'd say is that if you have a lot of improvements in the Middle Ages and you have a lot more people who are getting older, so it will have some sort of impact much later. So the nice thing about this is because some of them, you have a lag in this. So it can also tell you about what would happen much later if there are changes in the middle age mortality rates. You can actually try and trace it and see how it later impact. Yeah.
That probably leads on to a question, because there are some insurers who are talking about using mortality risk to offset longevity risk,
mm-hmm.
And that sort of thing. But I guess it's also... the other thing I'd be interested in is there's been papers done through Stapleton Inn about the cohort effect mortality improvements and that sort of thing. And are you seeing that sort of same sort of behaviour in the Australian mortality?
Yes, there's a cohort effect in Australian mortality. It's a bit tricky to try and put it into this sort of model. And when I fitted it, I tried to see if I could extract a cohort model, but I found then I ended up completely underestimating mortality. It just looked wrong. Yeah, so this actually works best if you try and think of it as an age period table, ignoring the cohort effect.
We find with the cohort effect, in this model, there's eight factors driving this, eight random factors. We find if you look at the older ages, with simpler models with just three factors, you capture the cohort effect in the third factor. You have a two-factor model, you can see the cohort effect. You add a third factor and you capture the cohort effect even in the age period model, because the cohort is just another direction. You just add the age and the period and you get cohort. So you're over-parameterising if you do both. But a third random factor, and there's eight here, so we would expect that we would capture that.
Just in this particular graph, mm-hmm. what's on the left y-axis? Yep.
On the y-axis?
Yep.
Oh, that's the actual values of the parameters.
Okay, if we go back a slide.
Mm-hmm. Forward?
No, where you actually specify the model.
Where I specify?
Where you specify the model, forms. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you say that the model is divided into three parts.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the first A, B, and C capture the first part till before the hump, D, E, F capture the hump,
mm-hmm.
and then the rest captures the later parts. So in your specification, when you're actually doing the time series, do you actually cut off the values of A, B, and C for particular ages, or do you keep on taking them all throughout?
We take them all throughout.
So I was wondering, does that actually work? Means, since you're defining the model for different particular age groups, shouldn't you cut off the values for those particular age groups and not carry them forward? It's just a question.
No.
You're adding those three curves together. Yeah, and so it's just three separate curves that are fitted across all the areas. But they dominate in different areas because the size is relatively speaking.
Okay.
The dotted line shows the first bit of the formula, doesn't it?
So
it drops off as your age goes off. So you act because you're older or something.
Yeah, this is this thumb. Then half that. That's this thumb. Then the red, the blue is the last one. So when you put them all together, you just get one nice curve.
Okay.
Yeah.
And another thing was, in the female mortality and the male mortality, the previous slide, they seem pretty similar. And you mentioned the same thing, but then why doesn't the model predict female but does well for the male?
They seem similar, but they're actually not.
You see here, you have this, then it goes smooth. But if you look here, you can see there's a bit more of an extra hump. So for female mortality, you'll find that there's often more than one hump. Essentially, the hump, the first hump that you find is the accident hump, which happens around age maybe 20 or so. But for females, there's also the maternal hump. And as the age at which women are having children is changing, it's not happening at the same time. So you find like you can have one hump, then another hump. Then there's also something that's going on with female mortality. We have like a third hump in some cases at around age 50. Now, this only, the Heligman-Pollard only has provisions for one hump. So it messes everything up.
That's the interesting concept to play around with. The
females are always harder to deal with.
So all the menopausal humps.
Well, thanks very much for a very interesting talk, and I think you communicated things very clearly, so it was quite easy to follow as a relative non-technician. And I did think of, like, imagining myself explaining to management why, we mentioned before, when you can predict it better, we're actually more uncertain. I have a feeling that they're not really going to go for that, but it's the reality of the model, and I think it's probably quite true. And I think I'm going to top the stakes in the stupid question department. In terms of backtesting, you know, you normally do the first part of the time series and then project into the future. Is it ever done where you fit it to the second part of the data and look backwards to see how well it fits? It's really just out of interest.
For this, it would be a bit tricky, because every time that you fit it, you'll get a different set of parameters. So unless you know what to work with, then go back on it. It would be very tricky. Mike?
Yeah, you could do it, but just run it backwards. Yeah. It's a good question. I've never seen it done. Or it's always you fit historically and then you project forward. Yeah, well, that might be. Well, Carol's almost finished a PhD. Don't throw a spanner in the works. Yeah, good point. That's good. Yeah, we like thinking beyond the mandate. Oh, sorry.
Maybe this is a stupid question as well. But one question I have is, how sensitive is your parameters changes depends on which period that you fit in? Since you said that if you fit later period, it probably will be very different from if you fit the early period. So how sensitive is?
Some of them are quite.
Okay. When you look like at the curve, let's, for example, we take the G because you have results for that. It's not, let me think. It's kind of sensitive because the way the model works is that it trains based on the most recent observations. So if you had a lot of decrease going on, then it'll capture quite a bit of the decrease going on. But if you had like decreasing levels of decrement, like what we had around here, then it captures some decrease, but to a decreasing level. So it's quite sensitive, because eventually what you see is that what we ended up with, it's not as flat, but it's not as steep. It gets somewhere in the middle. So it's quite sensitive, but it captures, it gives some weight and also still gets what's going on. Yeah. I don't know if that answers your question.
I was just going to ask, where do you see this being applicable going forward? I mean, I would have thought, you know, regulatory capital, that APRA would be really interested in this. Yeah, so that's the take forward.
What I'm doing now is I've actually been working on the APRA longevity risk margin, where we specify that a 99.5% confidence interval should be equivalent to a constant 25% decline in mortality. So that's what I've been testing with using this model. And I find that 25% is actually too much. It's much more than 95%, even with this very wide confidence interval. And I've been looking to see what they've been doing, for example, with Solvency II and the way they've brought it down. So that's the application that I'm doing with this model. I'll be presenting a paper during the colloquium for pension and superannuation in July. And by that time, I'll have all the results put together nicely into a presentation like this. Yeah.
And will we therefore get to name the parameter after you and that gets incorporated in the APRA standards?
Not going to happen. If you could go to the slide with the parameter where you're showing the stationarity on variable, that one, yeah. Mm-hmm. I was assuming that they're roughly in alphabetical order, and that the top one is the A for the infant mortality, which declines in a real world sense. That makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd
B.
The one that's interesting is the second one on the right hand side, where the male and female are very different. Is it? Yeah, could you tell me in real world terms what that one is?
That is the severity of it's how much the severity of middle age mortality. So you do find that males have a much higher middle age mortality than females. Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing that's noticeable, if you look at the last three on the right hand side, they all have a very significant sort of change very early on in your sample.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you have any real-world event that you could say might have caused that kind of thing, change in public health, or you've cut the wars out of it, haven't you?
Yeah, because this is from 1921, so this is just coming out of the swine flu. The Spanish flu.
Yeah, the Spanish flu, yeah.
Then here we have around the point where we had the wars. The second one. So those are the things that also could have brought a lot of volatility. And somewhere there, I think there's also the development of penicillin. The use of antibiotics came in somewhere there, so it would also have brought a severe. Yeah.
Thank you. You mentioned that the reason for the more effective fit with the males versus the females was the change in the timing of particularly the maternity hump, I think. No doubt it's possible to actually have the peak of the maternity hump doing a random walk.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
have you thought of doing that or experimented with doing that?
Not really. Yeah, because there's so many things that would affect the positioning of the maternity hump. Like for Australia, when the baby, the bonus was introduced, things changed. And you really cannot try and predict how the government is going to behave and how that will impact. So for females, it's actually quite complicated to do that.
It would be novel to try and do a multi-hump model for female mortality, which has that accident mortality, accident maternity and causal pumps to try and see if you actually get a better predictive model.
For the old age females, there is the Cole and Kiska model, but it's like from age 85 going on up, and it would change everything. It's a whole different system of models, but it could also work with that. Yeah.
One more try. You said tell you what you should do next. Yes, that's a brave one. No, you never asked anyone to do that before. But the thing that struck me is that I was at a session yesterday about securitization, and it appears to me that there are mortality securitization opportunities. And there was a comment, a loose sort of comment in the crowd here about. That you couldn't use this for certain types of things. You couldn't advise insurers to offset their longevity risk against their earlier mortality risk. But actually, you could use a model like this to segment the mortality experience in a securitization. And certainly, the goodness of fit appears to be a great deal better than anything we've seen than I've seen before in my limited experience. I think if you were to explore how a tool like this could be employed in that way, I think it would be very, very useful, particularly because securitization tends to do something that's like a sort of complement to diversification. It tends to take large, chunky risks and parcel them out into the economy. So mm-hmm. I think that would be very helpful. And congratulations, looks very interesting model.
Thank you.
Yeah, we are actually working on securitization, but it's a different model to this one. It's a three-factor model, but anyway. Yeah.
Well, thanks, everybody, for coming along. It was a great discussion, and let's thank Carol for a great presentation.
Thank you.